Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I'm producer Dave Scott, Stephanie Collins. You know the drill, we're recording on Wednesday morning. I was knocked off of Facebook. Apparently, a lot of people were knocked off all over the country. I have not been able to get back on. I can get back on my phone, but not on my computer, and I'm a Luddite. So please forgive me, those who follow me on my Facebook page, because you're going to find a very sort of significant paucity of information. But as I was thinking about social media and my reliance on all this stuff that happens, that's, you know, that's virtual, that's not real, I saw a study that was printed up at The Guardian. And I thought I would begin with my opening salvo, and then I'll go to my first guest. And here is the title of the piece. I literally called my daughter right after I read the article. Screen time robs the average toddler of hearing 1,000 words spoken by an adult a day, the study finds. So let me just read you a couple of sentences, and then I'm going to urge you to go to the Guardian article, because it is just incredibly depressing. The average toddler is missing out on hearing more than 1,000 words spoken by an adult each day due to screen time, setting back their language skills. A first-of-its-kind study has found. The research, published on Tuesday in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, tracked 220 Australian families over 2 years to measure the relationship between child screen use and the children's language environment. Families recorded all the audio around their child using advanced speech recognition technology over a 16-hour period on an average day at home. They repeated this process every 6 months between the ages of 12 and 36 months. The study found the average three-year-old in the study was exposed to 2 hours and 52 minutes of screen time a day. Researchers estimated this led to those children being exposed to 1,139 fewer adult words, 843 fewer child words, and 194 fewer conversations. This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. I called my daughter. We have my only grandchild is three, and my daughter is neurotic about this. She is very well aware of this. She spends the only time my granddaughter spends any time on screens at all. Actually, she's watching cartoons in Chinese because she's half Chinese, is when my daughter is tutoring online, which is only maybe an hour every other day. Otherwise, the conversation is exclusively with her, reading to her, talking to her, dialoguing with her, taking her out into nature. Please, please, please think about this. If you love your children, turn off the damn screens. Please get their eyes away from them. All right, now that I've gotten totally depressed, now I'm going to actually go completely downhill. So I am so excited to have met Cheryl Clark. She has been a medical and science journalist for more than 3 decades. She developed one of the nation's first beats on HIV/AIDS at a major newspaper in the early 1980s. She covered the rollout and rulemaking of the Affordable Care Act between 2009 and 2015. She's authored a 2018 series on diabetes. I could go on and on and on and just praise her journalism. But when it comes to her coverage of Medicare Advantage, I'm just going to tell you, everyone, go to MedPage today. And as soon as you see Cheryl Clark, you click. Okay, that's all I'm going to tell you. You click, because everything she writes about, especially when it comes to Medicare Advantage, is so enlightening. And she's incredibly fair. I mean, she goes to both sides, those that are applauding it, those that are criticizing it, and she gives you really in-depth discussions with these individuals. So when you step back, you really feel like you can make an informed decision. And I think that's the most important thing, is I want people to know exactly what is labeled as the advantage of Medicare Advantage, and then what in fact may be a significant disadvantage. So I'm going to ask Cheryl to join the program. I'm only going to get to one of your articles, Cheryl, but maybe it's because it's Don Berwick, who used to actually be a supporter of Medicare Advantage, because his critique is withering. It is withering. The title of your piece at MedPage today is Obama CMS Chief, Medicare Advantage Plans Game the System. Don Berwick says that their growth should be slowed or stopped. And with that, let me welcome back to the program by popular demand, Cheryl Clark. I'm so frightened by all the privatization that we have embraced on every level. It's not just Medicare. You and I both know it's happening in every single arena. And wherever you see it happening, whether it's in affordable housing, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in education, sadly, improvement isn't what you see. a larger expense is definitely what you see. And all of a sudden, we seem to spend more money without asking for any kind of, you know, accountability. And then we start tracking whether we're actually getting healthier or learning more or whatever it is. And once you begin to track that, the disappointment, Cheryl, becomes even greater. So let me welcome you to the program and share with us a little bit of the history of this Donald Berwick fellow, the pediatrician who was the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services during the Obama administration, because I think we need to understand his history to understand the critique he is offering us today, because it is a huge arc of change, but it is an arc of change that comes with initial support, and obviously incredible analysis that's both informed and with real knowledge. And therefore, what he is saying today should make everyone think twice. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Yeah, so this is kind of a sequel to an interview that I did with Michael Cherno, who's the head of the MedPAC, which is the Medicare Payment Advisory Board. They advise Congress on Medicare policy. And he was kind of bullish on Medicare Advantage, saying, you know, they don't, yes, there are trade-offs. We agree to a narrower network, and these plans, and they don't cost any money, and they have all these extra benefits. And he wasn't really, you know, I was asking Cherno the question, are we all going to be on a Medicare Advantage plan at some point? And he wasn't giving me a hard no on that, you know, because they're growing. They're now at 52% of all Medicare beneficiaries, and the projections are 60%, 70%. He said 90% in some parts of the country, Puerto Rico. And so he wasn't really giving me much of a hard no. And I was on your show last month talking about that. Thank you very much. So I decided to do an interview with Don Berwick, who I had kind of heard that I'd seen some stuff where he and another researcher, quality expert, had kind of said, hey, wait a minute, you know, there's some problems with these plans. And the story I submitted, by the way, to my editors, and thank you very much, it was 4,000 words. And they said, can you please cut it?
And I can't imagine what you left out, because what you kept in.
Well, I cut it a couple of 100 words, and they said, can you please cut it somewhere? And I said, well, okay, but can you take a look at it first? And they said, wait a minute, don't cut it.
See, I'm anyway. So glad. I'm so, honestly, God, everyone, when you read this, you read it, and then you go back, right? You go back and you want to reread the answer, and you're going, did he really say this? And let me just say something. You made a really interesting statement at the very beginning. And that is that, you know, you hear from your previous interview with the guy from MedPAC that it doesn't cost any money. Well, that's actually a fiction. It does cost more money. It may not cost more money for the person who's embracing the Medicare Advantage plan, but it is costing more money to the federal government. Because what I learned through reading your incredibly, incredibly brilliant article, which is this Q&A, is that it's now costing the feds, Medicare, like $88 million more.
$88 billion.
I mean, excuse me. There's never a million when you're talking to feds. Yeah. $88 billion more. So to say it's not costing more is a lie, because the question is, out of whose pocket is it coming? And of course, when you realize that people are frustrated with their co-pays and what they're expected to pay with Medicare, the idea that you would not be paying anything personally doesn't necessarily tell you what the federal government and Medicare is actually now increasing in the way of billions more to these Medicare Advantage plans. But it also doesn't tell you about what happens down the road, which is what you may be saving now, it may be costing you in the future. So again, you have to kind of look at the gestalt. And unfortunately, most people look at the immediacy of, oh, wow, I'm getting money back for groceries. Wow, I can go to a gym. Wow, I get a car ride. And they're looking at all this as if it's like, you know, manna from heaven. Yeah. But what they don't realize is this is a healthcare plan. This is not a ride share plan. This is not a gym plan. This is a healthcare plan. But they're selling you on the tchotchke. What they're not necessarily telling you is about how they're going to keep you healthy.
And by the way, you know, most of the people that I've talked with, including Cherno, acknowledge that these Medicare Advantage plans do cost the Medicare Trust Fund more. In fact, Berwick said it was $120 billion with a B.
Oh,
but they, you know, and then there are these efforts to stop the gaming that Berwick talks about, where they're upcoding to make you look sicker than you really are and blah, 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 blah. The industry is fighting back on that, and I have another story that kind of talks about how these Medicare Advantage plans, especially the for-profit ones, are kind of very I don't want to say secretively because you can find out about it, but in very subtle ways is what I'm trying to say, are cutting back on these extra benefits that so many of these ads are selling and wooing beneficiaries to enroll in these plans with, like the extra, the dental, the hearing. So they're increasing co-pays and they're dropping, the stipend for the free transportation. And the interesting thing on one of the other stories was that beneficiaries, a third of the Medicare Advantage enrollees aren't even using these benefits. So
Right.
that was a real shocker, by the way.
Well, but so interesting. Let me just remind everyone. So interestingly enough, the cell that you see ad nauseum on your TV set. I mean, if you've got your TV set on, I am like haunted by Medicare Advantage ads all the time. In fact, as I've learned from your brilliant article at MedPage today, Medicare Advantage bought ads on the Super Bowl during the Super Bowl. Well, now there's a cheap one
I
for you.
didn't know that either. Berwick told me that, and I said, "I don't have the football gene. I'm sorry, I got born without it." So I didn't see it, and he said, "Oh yeah, they were." And I found it. It was one of the. It's the lobby Better Medicare Alliance, Better
But
Medicare
these are the most expensive ads on television,
Alliance.
period. On television. So that's not exactly a health contribution. That's not exactly something that's going to make you healthier. It is, however, going to be an incredible marketing tool, which is exactly what they need to know. And then again, as we know that they're spending 88 to 120 billion more that Medicare is paying for, one of the things that we begin to learn is that, you're saying that maybe they lack transparency. And the thing is, yes, information may be out there, but if you can't figure out how to glean and get the information, it ain't out there. Because by definition, transparency should mean it's obvious. But if you create these barriers to transparency, it's not so obvious, number one. And number two, what you're also telling me is that they sell you, they upsell about what they're going to do it. And then once you are a participant, then they begin to erode all those benefits that they upsold you on. And I guess here's my question to MedPAC is that if you're looking at this, are you also looking at what was the initial contract and how soon after you signed that contract was that contract eroded by the exact same company? Because that means it's kind of a bait and switch. But here's the problem. It's a bait and switch on the part of the Medicare Advantage company, but you can't bait and switch and pull yourself out because getting out is almost impossible.
Oh,
Getting
there is. So we are in the re-enrollment period, and that was the third story
okay.
that I have to make this pitch because we have until March 31st, the end of this month, for people who are already in Medicare Advantage plans to check their benefits. There was a Kaiser Family Foundation study a few years ago, which actually, I think it was last year, which said, hey, beneficiaries don't check their Medicare Advantage benefits every year. They just roll it over 1 year after the other. So all of a sudden they show up at the doctor. Oh, the doctor isn't in network. And I have a great quote from a neurologist here in San Diego who's saying, yeah, it's a real sad time of the year. We dread this time of the year. And somebody would see it. And he said, because people show up and I said, I'm not in the plans network anymore. They changed things around. They dropped us or they, and so people are left with paying out of pocket, going home. They arranged for all sorts of care to get there, and then they're told, we're not in network anymore. We're not, your plan doesn't cover us.
But as you're talking about that, it's still open till the end of March. What bothers me is now I'm hearing from brokers and I'm hearing from people who are saying exactly what you're saying. Oh, but you're open. You can change until March 31st. Now you're making an assumption that the broker is acting in your best interest. What is, I think, problematic is who's actually paying the broker. It's probably not you. Who's paying the broker are other Medicare Advantage companies. And so part of the problem is that one, you may not check to see whether you're still getting the same benefits, but then you rely on a broker because you think by definition, the broker is your advocate. And then the question becomes, is the broker really your advocate or is the broker actually trying to negotiate so that you move to a different Medicare Advantage? Not because it's good for you, but it's good for the company. So I feel like it's like whack-a-mole. Every time I turn around, something seems to crop up to address address some of the things that you're talking about, but you're under the illusion that the person that you are negotiating with or talking to actually cares about you. Yeah. And it turns out that after reading your article and reading this interview, I was just so depressed because I don't know who to trust. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to believe, because every time I think that someone is giving me good guidance, the only thing I feel like I can trust is Medicare. But at the same time, because there are so many out-of-pocket expenses still with Medicare, you know, the 20% copay, the whatever, I am nervous because that sounds like an enormous amount compared to what Medicare Advantage is offering me. Mm-hmm. But it also depends on how ill I am. It depends on what my needs are. And you know, you could be healthy today and ill tomorrow. But if you're in Medicare Advantage and you're ill tomorrow, it's to your disadvantage. If you're ill tomorrow in Medicare, guess what? You may get the kind of coverage you need.
Yeah, you can go anywhere on Medicare. And that was one of Don Berwick's point, Dr. Berwick. He's a pediatrician, that you can go anywhere. And he, by the way, he would not be caught dead. I'm paraphrasing. That's not his exact words, but he wouldn't be in a Medicare Advantage plan, because if he gets cancer, he wants to be able to go to a comprehensive cancer center, an expert. If he has heart disease, he wants to be able to go to a cardiovascular center that does this all the time. And as he pointed out, and as I've pointed out in other stories, I've heard complaints from the MD Anderson people and the City of Hope people, and you know, that they're not in these networks. The Mayo Clinic isn't in the network if you want to go to the Mayo Clinic. So that's an important thing. I know we're running out of time, but I do want to get to some of the ways we could fix this that Berwick has
talked about
as we come to the end of this thing, which is that he wants to improve traditional Medicare, so that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to go into traditional Medicare because of the 20% cost, and because I wouldn't be eligible to buy a supplemental plan, or the supplemental plan is going to cost me $300 a month, and that's money I don't think I have, even though there's arguments against that because there are co-pays associated with Medicare Advantage services. But I don't want to confuse you. But what he's saying is, you know, that $120 billion, that $88 billion a year that we talked about, that Medicare Advantage is being, companies are being paid by the trust funds, the Medicare trust funds, which, by the way, that means you and me are taxpayer dollars, not like some secret fund that is proprietary. No, these are taxpayer funds that, you know, we paid into through our, you know, our
years of work.
That we can use this $120 billion to subsidize traditional Medicare so that you don't have these co-pays.
You wouldn't
have to buy a supplemental plan, and it would be more attractive to people. And you can add in with traditional Medicare the hearing, the dental, the you know, the
all the things that are part of health. They're all part of my health. My brain is not separate from my body. My mouth is not separate from my body. You can die from a rotted mouth. I mean, I just want to be, as I'm thinking about this, so let me mirror back something so I understand something. So when we're talking about the $88 billion to $120 billion, is that more dollars than they're currently getting?
Correct.
Is that an addition?
All right. Patients and you went, or beneficiaries, and you put them in traditional Medicare, they wouldn't. It would cost that much less. Yes, that's right.
Okay. So what I understand, but one of the arguments, and I read this in your article, was that the plan was, if you put in a capitated rate, so you're paying X number of dollars per person, therefore they would have the incentive not to be wasteful, not to be potentially harmful, yada, yada. But what I'm hearing from your article is, but if you keep raising the capitated rate, then that incentive to be less wasteful and potentially harmful, you're beginning to drain that out, because what they're doing is they're upcoding. They're creating the illusion of people being sicker. Then they argue for a higher capitated rate, and then they get the higher capitated rate, and then they don't give you what you ultimately need in order to treat you for all those illnesses that really don't exist because they've kind of upcoded you. So I mean, I feel like it's a scam. They know exactly how to play the game.
Yeah, the two ways that this $88 billion comes into play is, number one, they're getting more. Like, say I'm a healthy 75-year-old woman, and if I were in a Medicare Advantage plan, the capitated monthly rate would be $500. Well, I broke my wrist, so Medicare Advantage, and this is true story. True story that I broke my wrist. So Medicare, if I were in a Medicare Advantage plan, which I'm not, they would come into my chart and they would say, "Oh, she broke her wrist. She's at risk for osteoporosis. Maybe she had syncope. Maybe she fainted when she broke her wrist. She fell. Oh, this is high risk. We're going to tack on risk of dementia." So now they code me for all these things that I've never been, treated
Right,
for. The
right.
OIG went back into the records and said, not me, but went back into the records and said, "Oh, she was never treated for any of this stuff. This is fraud."
Yeah.
So that's how they get that one. And the second way in which this idiot is, they're denying and delaying care. And Don Berwick mentioned that I asked him, I said, "Well, is this delay and deny? Delay and deny, is this basically just playing the float because they eventually may approve a lot of these?" And he said, "Yeah, they're basically earning interest off of the the time that they're not paying these
Well,
bills." So
right, but let me just say something else about the delay and deny. First of all, let's remember we're talking about an older population. They have to be over 65. Okay, so let's start with
no.
that.
Yeah, disabled and blind or Medicare
Okay,
eligible.
but all right, disabled and blind, but for the most part, and the vast majority are Medicare. So we're going to use it. Well, let's keep it simple for everybody. Let's say you're going to be old, and basically, here's the good
You're
news
going to
about
have
being.
needs, is the point. If you, because if you're disabled and blind, you're also going to have needs.
Right,
Your
right.
needs.
No. They're all gonna have new, but the when you're over the age of 65, then they can also do a sort of calculation on how much longer you're gonna live. So sometimes when you delay and deny, you're also not only saying maybe you're hoping that you will in fact be reimbursed for this, or maybe you're hoping that you won't make it. Like I'm on death watch right now. I've got two people that are dying. Okay, that I'm literally, I'm on death watch. One is 103. She was not exactly the great thing for Medicare Advantage because she actually outlived everybody. The other person is 70. Okay. That means that he's only been on Medicare. So if you delay or deny at age 69, he'd be almost dead in a year. So there's again, it's not only that you're hoping that you get compensated, but you're also playing the waiting game because you're dealing with an older population that, we're not talking about 40-year-olds that still have another life expectancy of 25 years. You're talking about 65-year-olds. And sometimes a lot of them come in so unhealthy anyway at age 65, they may not make it to 66. So I mean, the kind of scam that I feel Medicare Advantage has become is they become expert on the sell, but not expert on all the sort of rationales that they would improve this system, make people healthier, save money. Every checkbox in this article that you wrote, they don't check. They don't do all the promises. And yet, as you point out, how many of us are going to be in the program because either we're forced into it or we think that we're getting something better when we're not?
Yeah, and that was another point that Don Berwick made, which was that the Medicare Advantage plans say, "Well, we deliver better care."
Yeah.
Well, the problem is when you're I don't know what the correct word is, but you're making people appear sicker. You don't have an apples to apples comparison.
Right. Exact. And
So
they are
there's
so
no
it's
reliable
illusion.
data to show that. And he was one of the, he was one of the biggest proponents of Medicare Advantage. He was even worked for one a few years back. He's in Boston. I remember I was at a meeting with him. I've interviewed him many times, but I was in a meeting where he was the keynote speaker. God, this must have been 10 years ago. And I remember he said, "We have so much unnecessary care in traditional Medicare that if you took half of the interventional cardiologists out of the picture and made them retire, you wouldn't hurt anybody because
Right.
there's so much unnecessary, wasteful, and potentially harmful care." And that was the point for Medicare Advantage, which I originally thought was a good idea, and I even enrolled in one when I first became eligible. So,
Right.
but it's just not gone that way. And everybody who's in a Medicare Advantage plan really needs to think about what could possibly happen to them, where they might be able to get care, and check their
Oh.
plan, check their doctors this year before, your April appointment, so you don't show up and
Oh, this is,
get told
this
to
is,
go home.
Someday I want to just do a series because as I'm listening to you talk about Medicare Advantage, the other day we were talking about vouchers and for education and the idea that would give parental choice and they would get the choice of a parochial school or a private school. And then you find out that it's not even their choice because the parochial school can say no to you. The private school can say no to you. So here you're selling it as parental choice. And actually all you're doing is using public dollars. So parochial schools can decide to say yes or no. Private schools can decide to say yes or no. And they don't have to worry about you chalking up the money because the public dollars are coming out of the public education fund. So as I'm listening to you, the initial idea is a good idea. And I can understand why Dr. Berwick liked the idea. But then, when he saw how the idea got bastardized because the profit motive became the incentive, not the health motive, well, there you go. Please, MedPage today, follow anything Cheryl Clark writes because she's so thorough. She gives you both sides, so you get to weigh the information and then really check. You have till March 31st your Medicare Advantage plan. Obama CMS chief, Medicare Advantage plans game the system. What's the word? Game. Don Berwick says Medicare Advantage growth should be slowed or stopped. Thank you so much for all you do and for your thorough writing. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Arnie. This was fun again. I appreciate
Oh, I love it. I love it. Anyway, this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It produces Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
AIDS activist Hydea Broadbent had no choice but to be brave. I'm Bill Newman. This is the Civil Liberties Minute, and that's how The Week magazine began its recent story about Hydea Broadbent. Hydea Broadbent's biological mother had been addicted to drugs, and she had been put up for adoption. Then, at age 3, Hydea was diagnosed with HIV, and she wasn't expected to live past age 5. Hydea Broadbent's HIV developed into AIDS, and the stigma around AIDS at that time was so great that if she sneezed, her kindergarten teacher sprayed her with Clorox. Hydea Broadbent was a vivacious child, and she began speaking publicly about AIDS when she was 6. She appeared on Nickelodeon, a special with basketball superstar Magic Johnson, just after Magic revealed that he was HIV positive, and on Oprah and Good Morning America. And at age 11 in 1996, she addressed the Republican National Convention where she said, "I am the next Maya Angelou. I may even be the first woman president. I am the future, and I have AIDS." As Magic Johnson said, Hydea changed the world with her bravery. Thanks to her, millions were educated, stigmas were broken, and attitudes about HIV/AIDS changed. We are indebted to Hydea Broadbent for her courage and activism and mourn her passing in February at age 39. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. when it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
To with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, we continue to record on Wednesday morning. The two stories that we're doing on Thursday almost feel like a bit of bookends. It's kind of like what happens when you begin to sort of privatize things that are necessary. Healthcare is necessary. Should we be privatizing it? Knowledge and information that we get from journalists is necessary. It's essential for a democracy. And to some extent, are we beginning to sort of quasi-privatize it through what we call grants or whatever they create to fund nonprofits? So as I was reading these two stories together, I realized that they were so appropriate because in some ways they really are windows in on each other. And I will start by saying that I was never aware of a site called civileats.com. I'm like, it's been around apparently for 15 years, but I have not been familiar with it. But I'm going to need to start checking back on it on a more regular basis because the article that caught my attention was entitled Walmart Heirs Bet Big on Journalism. A wash of Walton family funding to news media is creating echo chambers in environmental journalism and beyond. Are editorial firewalls up to the task? Joining us right now is the author of that piece, Bill Lasher. He is an author, journalist, and historian. His latest book, The Golden Fortress, California's Border War on Dust Bowl Refugees, describes the LAPD's 1936 deployment of armed police officers to California state lines aimed at keeping poor domestic migrants out of the Golden State. His debut, Eve of 100 Midnights, recounted the true story of two journalists in love in China and the Philippines at the onset of World War II. And I know you have a new book coming out. Is it newer than the one that was written up in your bio? What is the book that's coming out, I believe, at the end of this month, Bill?
That's called A Danger Shared, A Journalist's Glimpses of a Continent at War. And it's wartime photography from the journalist Melville Jacoby, who was the subject of that first book, Eve of 100 Midnights. So it's photos of Asia during World War II that haven't been seen before.
Well, I interviewed someone who went back into the photo journalism about the Japanese and Chinese Americans that were warehoused in camps in California. And the title of his amazing book of photography was entitled Un-American. Mm-hmm. And it's was one of the most powerful things I'd ever visually seen. And then he described. This story about the Waltons is not a story about the Waltons. It's a story about wealth. You could look at it when you look at who owns the Washington Post. You could look at it at just a whole number of struggling newspapers or failing smaller local papers that are suddenly realizing that, you know, they used to be vibrant. They used to have offices in the Capitol. They used to have offices around the state. Now they maybe offer you a newspaper of two pages. They struggle to find journalists. They can't compensate them. And many of them have shut their doors. And so in order to sort of compensate from that, you mentioned in your article that not only have we seen the loss of newspapers, but we've seen the rise of these sort of nonprofit sites where just a couple of years ago, there may have been a handful of them. Now there are hundreds. But in order for you to be a nonprofit site, somebody has to pay you. And I think in some ways that backs us into the story that you are then telling about the story of the Walton heirs. So why don't you share a little bit about, we'll use the Waltons as our example, because that's where you go to, because it's not just a story of the fact that they're cutting checks for journalism. They are so rich. They are the largest supplier of groceries in America. They have an interest in lots of things. And after reading your story, I almost wanted like graph paper, and I wanted to be able to shade it in wherever the Walton money goes. Because all of a sudden you realize it's going to this nonprofit, it's going to this newspaper, it's going to this organization that claims to be environmental, it's going to this farmer, it's going here. And that by the time you get done, you feel like it's the Waltons covering the Waltons. There's no line of demarcation. And therefore the question becomes, are we covering what's good for America or the facts that we need, or are we covering things that the Waltons want to massage so that ultimately what you are doing is actually acting in their financial interest, not necessarily in the interest of the river or the community or the farmer, because they have their fingers everywhere.
Yeah. And I think it's a very complex question to unpack. And this story that I wrote is just part of a much larger conversation, two much larger conversations. One about the influence that wealth has in a variety of different ways in society, and in the future of journalism. And in my case, my piece for Civil Eats was just one of many pieces that Civil Eats did as part of this ongoing investigation about Walmart's philanthropic efforts and how that overlaps with food policy and the planet. And I'm a contributor to Civil Eats. I was asked originally to help them with their research for that project, some of the background, some of the sort of deep dives into information as other reporters pursued a number of different stories about where Walmart and its the members of the Walton family, who are the heirs, mostly the part of the family of the heirs to Sam Walton, have been spending their money, both in terms of investment and then also in terms of philanthropy. And so I can best speak to this aspect of journalism. So they came back to me later on and wanted to do a story about their philanthropy in the journalism world, where it overlapped with food and policy, and to look at how the reporters, particularly, and editors who worked within the organizations funded by philanthropy that came from individual Walton family members and the Walton Family Foundation, where they directed those, where those, how those reporters squared that work. And so it's a complicated question because it's about inheritance, it's about media, it's about journalism, it's about influence. And so to answer that, yeah, it could take a year.
And I want to again remind everyone how we got to this place, because you have a paragraph at the very beginning of your piece at Civil Eats. Journalism is welcoming the new infusion of philanthropy. Since the decline of the industry's ad-driven business model was hastened by the Great Recession, more than half of newspapers have shuttered across America. Can I repeat that statistic? More than half of newspapers have shuttered across America, and the industry has shed more than 20,000 jobs. 13 years ago, fewer than a dozen digital news nonprofits led the charge to shift news to a nonprofit model. Now there are more than 400 digital news nonprofits nationwide, supported by ever-growing coalition of philanthropies that include the Walton Charities. So I think, again, it's important to remember where we are, why we need these nonprofits. And I'm a person who, you know, initially was always going over to one of the original nonprofits that was wildly successful, VT Digger. And VT Digger really sort of stepped in Vermont to cover for what was happening to the Rutland Herald and the Burlington Free Press. And they became really the most important news source for me. And they became wildly successful. But of course, that also means they have to support themselves. So the question then becomes, where are they getting their checks, number one? And then I saw that we saw the exact same thing happening in my state. And I was, you know, on the ground initially with a group called In-Depth New Hampshire. And now In-Depth New Hampshire is now, you know, a lot more successful than it was at the very beginning. But they, too, were responding to the loss of so many papers in my state, you know, and they were stepping in. But then again, the question becomes, who is funding them? And I think, Bill, what was so interesting about your piece wasn't that the Waltons, you know, at least claim to their foundations that they are, you know, they there's no strings attached to the money that they are giving, yada, 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 that they want to see that these issues about the environment or about the water or about the farming is covered. And you get the sense that they really want to support accuracy and facts. But what was so scary about your piece is, and then you look at where the rest of their money is going, it's just not going into journalism. It's going into some of the environmental groups that are supposedly the watchdogs. And then it's going into some of the farmers in the agribusiness, supposedly that are being covered. And then it's going into, so by the time you begin to look at the journalists, not only are they attached to the Waltons with money, but everything that they're covering is attached to the Waltons and their money. So then the question is, how do you figure out, how do you disclose? And how do you figure out what you're actually getting is real for the purposes of the public benefit or real for the profit benefit ultimately of the Waltons?
Yeah, it's a really difficult thing to answer. And I think one of the things that happens in this case is it puts a lot of responsibility or burden is not quite the right word on the audience, on the reader, to determine that influence, because many of these news organizations that receive money from the Waltons or from other philanthropies, you know, Pacific has, of course, a funded, you know, nonprofit organization, NPR, so many other journalism organizations have these issues about who's giving the money, even private news organizations, who's advertising. And so a lot of nonprofits have taken this approach to decide to declare very clear firewalls between editors and publishers and between donors and the people who are taking in the money and the editorial side, and then another layer of transparency. But that transparency requires a certain literacy in the public's mind to understand whether, you know, what's going on here, to make those connections that maybe journalists should be making. And that is something that I wonder about, and something that I never really got the bottom to. Every journalist involved that I spoke to, and not, a lot of journalists would not speak to me because they would kind of point me in the direction of their editors or the heads of their organizations. But of those I spoke to, and of those who I talked to sort of more broadly for this story, are trying their best, or at least express that they're trying their best, and they sound sincere, to do good journalism and to be clear. But they have to be clear about that. And that's added work on people who are already working very hard. And when they work in these worlds of, this is what I think you're getting to, they work in these worlds of organizations where the voices they hear and the voices that are legitimized are often in the same circles of the people who are funding them. So you do have to ask the question of what voices are being heard and what voices are being left out. And one thing that I constantly asked these reporters and had on my mind repeatedly was, you know, when we cover other subjects, we cover, say, politicians lobbying or lobbying of a politician or campaign expenditures of a local candidate or of a government official, all of these things, the government officials or the politicians often say, well, you know, I make the decisions that are best for my constituents, and I don't let that money influence me. I think that's a pretty age-old line that we hear. And I always ask that of the reporters I spoke with, and they just turn around and point to their transparency policies. And it becomes this question of, well, if you're asking that question, shouldn't you also be asking that question of yourself?
And the line that you also, I pulled out of your very, very well-sourced article was, how could newsrooms track, much less disclose, all these connections in an era of shoestring budgets and widespread layoffs? So you're not only asking about the money that's coming in to fund the organization, but then you have to start asking the money that's funding the group that you're actually covering. You know, it says that it's the Clean Whatever Project, or it says it's, you know, the Watershed Group, or it says it's whatever. And then you have to start asking, so like, who funds you? So, you know, you've got your own funding issues, and you've got the funding issues of who you're covering, and then you have the funding. I mean, it's like, it's an octopus. You know, every time you turn around, it's someone else is massaging, and there's money coming in from somewhere else. And to the point where you almost go crazy because you're trying to figure out, you know, how much do I disclose in this article before I actually get to the article? And then am I actually getting a firewalled piece of information, or is there influence? And Bill, I'll just tell one of the thousands of stories, because I've been both in commercial radio, I've been in nonprofit radio, I've done it all. Okay. I've worn many, many hats, and I'll never forget being hired to do a talk TV show. And I was hired to do a talk TV show that was about sort of the issues of the day. Okay. And I was on every night, and it was talk television. And it was a smallish TV station that covered on Northern Massachusetts and Southern New Hampshire and a portion of Maine. And I was paid, not so much, but at the 6 month mark, we had to renegotiate the contract. So listen to what happened. They said, okay, we're going to renegotiate the contract. We're going to almost triple your salary. Whoa. Okay. I'm like thinking, this is amazing. But then listen to what they said. But you will have no input into content. And I went, excuse me? You will have no input into content. Now, if you know anything about me, and you can sort of imagine what I'm like, I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this. The reason I do this is that people trust me. They trust my eye. They trust my questions. They trust where I want to go. And if you are now going to direct and order the direction in which I go, then this is no longer my show. And I said, it's a deal breaker. And the newsroom director said, I told that to my boss. And they said, oh, she won't turn down the money. And then he said, she will. And I did. And Bill, I got blacklisted. Mm. Okay. Difficult to work with, they say, Bill. Difficult to work with. Why? Because I want some integrity in the work that I do. So as I'm reading your piece, this is not a new story. This happened in the early 2000s. Okay. This happened like 20 years ago. So what you're telling me, you're not protected when we still sort of had newspapers or we still sort of had TV stations. There was always this sort of advertiser ownership issue about, don't be too provocative, don't be whatever. But it's gotten much, much, much worse. And in some ways, from reading your article, I feel like it's almost more clandestine, that all of it is happening, but it's happening in a deeper, more insidious way. So it's even harder to track. But in some ways, maybe the influence is greater because it's almost synergistic, because it's happening in every aspect of what it is that we cover.
I caution on words like clandestine, because okay. I think that there are a lot of good journalists working in these efforts, and there may very well be very good intentions behind this effort. It's always impossible to answer that question, right. Of course. Limited, sort of, you're talking about, you pointed that line about shoestring budgets, and I was myself limited by my time, my resources, and my availability, as well as the space available for this story, which did evolve over time. But the fact that there are very large pools of resources available, both from the Waltons and in other philanthropies, in terms of who is funding journalism, all these big journalism nonprofits, and private news organizations as well. I mean, the Report for America decided that they're not going to place reporters any longer at hedge fund owned publications. So that's a reminder that there are publications and news outlets owned by hedge funds. But you talked at the beginning about privatization and the scene, sort of this book ending, that other piece, the other guest that you had on. I do think it's important also to note that privatization has existed in journalism it's always been a private industry.
Right.
And
no,
so we're exploring this world of nonprofits, but it's very much a frontier. It's very much, sort of still being defined what is going to work in nonprofit journalism and what isn't, and what else will need to happen to ensure that the journalism that happens over the next century is serving the public as much as it is serving the interests of those who are funding it. And I think that is something that I wished to have answered in this story, but of course I couldn't. I just think my interest in continuing the work on the story was driven by this idea that more people should know sort of the sausage making behind journalism. And I wish that more people were willing to sort of connect the dots, and we're excited about connecting the dots in the same way, among journalists, in the same way that we're willing to connect the dots about the stories that we cover and the sources that we cover.
So let me stop you for a second though, Bill, because one of the things that I sort of gleaned from your piece about the Waltons is that we have a lot of billionaires in America today. That's more than we've ever had. And we even saw an increase in billionaires during the pandemic. and the difference now is that when you are so rich, you can put your money into so many different things. So you're not just putting your trust fund money or your foundation money into journalism. You are putting it now into a whole conga line of other investments. And so as a result, you don't just sort of step back and say, oh, where do I want to spend my money like fairy dust? You make an informed decision. And you look at, where is my money initially coming from? Is it coming from food sources? Is it coming from the river? Is it coming from whatever? And then you sort of look at what are the feeders into maybe protecting that river or protecting that farmer or protecting ConAg or the big agriculture. And so as we are talking about journalism and covering these things, one of the things that just blew my mind about the Waltons is that if you actually look at all the places, they are literally cutting checks, and groups that you would think, they sound environmental, why would they take Walton money? Or they sound like they want to protect the groundwater, why would they take Walton money? Or they do whatever. And then you find out that there is a connection to these foundations that are controlled by Walton. And it then becomes, I think, a little more frightening because we got too many really rich people with money to burn. And they don't want to necessarily spend it on, you know, the public's ultimate need, but they do want to spend it on what will ultimately keep them rich. And what keeps them rich may also make us poorer as a society and as an economy.
Yeah, I think that is a very salient point. And I think that these, you know, another piece of the story that I was, you know, that I got into was some of the explicitly stated goals of some of the sort of strategy and policy making that different parts of the Walton family supported, such as issues around the Colorado River and its watershed. And these ideas that, you know, there are goals about building the public's attention for water issues, very broadly stated, very, you know, open, but that a media aspect of that strategy would be there. Or in the case of the Walton Family Foundation, which is the sort of overarching philanthropic charitable organization on behalf of the heirs of Sam Walton, there is this strategy in there, I believe it's called their Strategy 2025. I may get the name wrong right now, but Strategy 2025 had an explicitly stated goal of nurturing and supporting journalism. And as I describe in the piece, what the reason for that is part of a bigger picture. You know, I think that the Family Foundation would certainly argue that that is part of their interest in supporting independent journalism. Whether that independence is actually there is the question that is going to remain for the public to answer. I do know that the Family Foundation wrote an extensive response to my piece, you know, noting, for example, that Civil Utility Report received money even for at least one story that mm-hmm. was partially funded by Walton Family Foundation work. So I think they really do want to express their support for environmental journalism. And I think the question is, what is the reason behind that support?
And you actually, in some ways, begin to both answer that question, and you talk about interviewing a former editor of the Boulder Weekly, who said reporting on the Waltons' influence on the future of the Colorado River is the most important story in the region. He said Walton Philanthropy supports efforts to convert water rights into a market-based system. And he believes Walton funding in journalism chills reporting on their initiatives. The effect is that it's compromising newsrooms and journalists in the same manner that agribusiness dollars such as Monsanto have compromised ag science and undermined academic research. The Waltons have no intention of buying water rights so that the river can have more water. The only thing they're trying to save is the economic vitality and the profit that can be made from the Colorado River. And again, so you're supposedly protecting the river for what purpose? You're then writing and underwriting the journalists who cover the people that are trying to protect the river for what purpose? And then you have these, you know, these nonprofits or whatever that are covering it that don't have a tremendous amount of money to do the dissecting, to ask the questions, to be able to do the exposure. And I can see that the Walton Foundation was probably perturbed at your article, Bill. But that's what happens when you put sunlight on something. You expose the benefit, money, and the liability, money. And your piece was very powerful, sobering. And again, it goes to the question is, we know that we're heading into a 2024 election where facts seem to be expendable. And where do you find, you know, the information you need to process, and what's real and what's Memorex? And not only is your power in the vote, your power is in raising questions. And we've gotten a little bit sloppy in both. And now more than ever, we can't be quite so sloppy. And I think that's really what your article points to. It's putting a tremendous burden on all of us. One that we think, oh, I'm already overworked. But you know what? If you have a future, be prepared to do a lot more work. So I am very, very grateful for what you've done. And I was never familiar with Civil Eats. And let me explain it to my audience. Civil Eats is a member of the Institute for Nonprofit News. It receives funding from the Walton Family Foundation. You point this out. Civil Eats participates in Newsmatch, an annual grant-making INN program, but has not accepted offers of individual grants from the Walton Family Foundation via INN. And Bill Lasher was a member of the Society for Environmental Journalists from 2010 to 2017. And I am grateful for the article that you wrote. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for bringing this article to more listeners' attention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This, everyone, is a Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnest. Our producer today has got Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao.